The story of the Iraq War from the inside. Welcome to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson. Fred Anderle is off today. We have read the stories. We have seen their pictures. We have heard the voices from the battlefield or from downtown Baghdad. And we've seen the grainy video from a satellite phone. But that's only the end product of the dangerous work conducted by journalists covering the Iraq War. These journalists have been both praised and criticized for their work, but that work indeed will help write the history of the Iraq War in the years to come. The Columbia Journalism Review offers a terrific first-person summary of the experiences of about four dozen journalists who covered the Iraq War. The book, Reporting Iraq, an oral history of the war by the journalists who covered it. Its editor, Mike Hoyt, from the Columbia Journalism Review, is our guest this hour on Open Line. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. We will discuss the reporters, what they faced. We'll also discuss the current situation in Iraq and how reporters are telling that story now. We welcome your phone calls at 292-8513, and we welcome your emails also at openline@wosu.org. Mike, let's just first start with the general reporting of this war. How is it different from reporting during other wars during the TV age, especially? I mean, the media has changed a lot since, say, World War II. But how is the Iraq War reporting different than, say, Vietnam or the first Gulf War?
Well, Vietnam, you could move around. You could sort of hitchhike on with this group or that group or this truck or that helicopter and cover sort of at will. This is a much more dangerous environment. I mean, there were fronts and sort of you knew roughly. I mean, it was confusing in Vietnam as well, but you knew roughly where the danger was, and you could, you know, take care of yourself in that way. Here, the danger is sort of everywhere. I mean, in this war, it's really in there's three or four different chapters to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it first started, reporters could go everywhere, and almost to a person, the people in our book talk about that opening chapter as just a remarkable journalistic opportunity. In a way, it was a chance to get to know a Middle Eastern country in a way that hadn't happened. In a way, you could go anywhere and talk to anybody, you know, Fallujah, whatever, and they tell stories of, you know, one guy's car broke down and he hitchhiked into Fallujah, you know, stuff that you just couldn't do. And people were eager to talk. They'd been through all this stuff under Saddam, and they were kind of bubbling up with, you know, one reporter said not only would they talk, you couldn't shut them up.
This was post-invasion.
Post
the fall of the statue, the iconic image,
yeah,
but before the insurgency got going.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't last long. The disorder sort of just mutated into an insurgency, and pretty soon reporters began to realize that they were in danger.
Now, the first Gulf War, there were complaints that the reporters were too locked down. The military, especially during the invasion stage, tried to loosen that up a little bit.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they came up with this embedding idea, mm-hmm. which, you know, there's a lot to say about it, and it's enables people to cover things that they couldn't cover. It also, you know, there's downsides to it as well.
What these folks tell terrific. I mean, they really are personal stories and how it affected them personally. And you know, you get some insights into their coverage that may not have shown up in the newspaper or on television or on the radio. What motivates these correspondents, these photographers, these videographers, to go into harm's way and to cover this story?
Well, I think it's a mix of things. I mean, first of all, it's, you know, reporters, especially certain kind of reporters, you know, love the big story, and this is certainly, you know, this is a really big story, you know, sort of history happening in a hurry, and it's fascinating, and you know, I'm sure there's some sense of adventure. There's also a sense of bearing witness. I mean, that you know, if you're gonna I happen to think some of these reporters are among the best of journalists. Mm-hmm. They really have a sense of bearing witness. You know, if you know, a nation decides to go to war and spend all this money and spill all this blood, you need somebody to bear witness and sort of constantly be asking how it's going. Is it worth it? Is progress being made? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? You know, that you need somebody to bear witness, and they answer that call, I think.
Now, Hollywood tends to portray war correspondents, or people in tough places reporting the news, as sort of being, renegades in a way, nothing to lose, no real families. What's the personal story behind these reporters? Do they have families? Do they have spouses? Do they have did they have sort of comfortable reporting jobs before this war broke out?
Well, I think it's a mix. A lot of them are people who have tended to go to foreign countries all along. Mm-hmm. Richard Engel from NBC, he was actually, covering Iraq well before the war. Jane Araf of CNN, she's gone all over the world. Peter Moss, he does all of New York Times Magazine. He does everything from oil to war to, whatever the big story is. I mean, they are Dexter Filkins was, I'm not sure what he was doing before the war, but he certainly gravitated to the war. He's from the New York Times. Nancy Youssef from Knight Ridder, she just kind of got into this thing. I mean, she hadn't done anything like this before, and she became, quite a heroic reporter. She's sort of concentrated on civilian deaths and really did some great reporting on that score. I think from all over, and of course, we tried to talk to European and Arab journalists as well. There's one guy whose story just sticks with me. His name's Ali Fadil. He'd been a doctor in Iraq, and his family was over there, and mixed Shia and Sunni family. And when this started, he just slowly gravitated toward journalism. He wanted to bear witness, really. He wanted to bear witness on his own country, and he became a translator and fixer, sort of, and slowly became a journalist in his own right. In fact, he's still going back and forth to do stories from over there.
292-8513, 292-8513. We're speaking with Columbia Journalism Review Executive Editor Mike Hoyt. He edited a compilation of stories from about four dozen journalists who covered the Iraq War in a book called Reporting Iraq, An Oral History of the War by the Journalists Who Covered It. We welcome your phone calls at 292-8513.
I should add, it's not a whole lot of, fun. I mean, it's a very difficult and hard story, and once the insurgency got underway and, mm-hmm. and reporters realized they were there's a lot of stories in here. They were chased in high speed crashes, and they were stoned, and they were a lot of guns held to their head. One young woman when she went to a morgue, just lots of narrow escapes, and it became very frustrating. It became hard to get out unless you were embedded or unless you were using Iraqis to do the reporting for you.
It has been incredibly dangerous. We've heard the big stories of Bob Woodruff and David Bloom who died as an embedded reporter, and Bob Woodruff who was seriously injured, and his career basically was derailed because of an injury there. But there have been 200 journalists about 200 journalists in support staff, whether they be fixers or translators and things like that, who have died covering this war.
That's correct.
So they have to go through – I mean, this isn't just sitting in a briefing room waiting for the general to give you the facts or the tolls of the day. They are with the troops wearing flak jackets and helmets and sleeping in Humvees and on the sand and things like that.
In large measure. And then a lot of it is very sort of tedious, mm-hmm. sitting in an office and waiting for reports from an Iraqi staffer who mm-hmm. Is also risking his or her life. Double-checking. And I know Dexter Filkins said at one point that it just takes about 4 hours to do over there what it would take half an hour, somewhere else. It's just slow progress because of the restrictions.
Mm-hmm. How about the logistics? I mean, you hear stories; they don't have power all day long. Communication can't be that great. Just the things we take for granted here, reporting the news stateside, have to be just a tremendous difficulty over there.
Well, I think they can be tough. Mm-hmm. One thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is the expense of it, and I think that's in part why. Why there are so many fewer reporters there now. I mean, I think there are other reasons as well. But, I think the Times Bureau told us they spend something like $3 million a year, just not counting salaries, on that bureau, which includes, you know, security guards and armored vehicles and insurance and all that kind of stuff. And it's very expensive.
Women have a particularly hard time reporting on this war because of the culture there and the role of women in the Arab culture.
Yeah, to some extent, although a few of them talked about certain advantage because some people are not as wary of them, of women as they are of men. And, you know, in a few cases, they were able to wear burqas and just kind of glide around and see things, you know, covered up. Although one of them talked about how she had to learn to walk. her staff kept telling her, "You're walking like an American, you know, head high, looking around." It became a little obvious. But, I mean, women, an awful lot of women are in this book, and they did an awful lot of good reporting.
Mm-hmm. You talked to two women who've reported for NPR, Deborah Amos and Ann Garrels.
Yes, Ann Garrels.
Voices we've heard a lot.
Yeah. I mean, Ann Garrels was very honest in this book about the effect of things. I mean, she went into Fallujah during the larger invasion and quite freely admits that it really... you know, you see things like that, and it has an effect on you. And she talked about going home to some R&R with her family, and they went skiing, and they apparently shoot these guns to trigger landslides so that they won't fall on people later. Mm-hmm. And she just sort of fell apart and hadn't realized she was so, you know, stressed, post-traumatic stress. I mean, she put on a pack and went with those people, and a lot of people were hurt and killed in that invasion, and you know, she was right there with them.
292-8513, 292-8513. If you have a question or a comment for Columbia Journalism Review executive editor Mike Hoyt, he was the editor of the book Reporting Iraq, an Oral History of the War by the Journalist Who Covered It. Mike, why do this story? Why share these reporters like to stay out of the story. Why did you feel it was important to tell these stories, give the reporters a chance to give an oral history of what they saw, you know, three or four years later?
That's a good question. I mean, I think part of it was that we think they stay out of the story too much in a way. One of our contributing editors, Mike Massing, came up with this idea, and we just leaped on it and wanted to do it. But another motivation was there had been this, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal named Farnaz Fasihi, who, she had this incident in which she sent a regular email to friends and family, and one of them one of those emails, they usually kept it pretty chatty and basically I'm okay and what I'm doing, but late 2004 I think she her frustrations got the best of her and she wrote something kind of stronger. And somebody posted it on the web, and it instantly went around the world, and it was a big controversy because reporters are not supposed to show their feelings and or their politics or so forth. Let me just read a piece of it.
Sure, please.
She said she was talking about being a foreign correspondent in Baghdad. It says like being under virtual house arrest. I leave when I have a very good reason to and a scheduled interview. I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore, can't eat in restaurants, can't strike a conversation with strangers, can't look for stories, can't drive in anything but a full armored car, can't go to scenes of breaking news stories, can't be stuck in traffic, can't speak English outside, can't take a road trip, can't say I'm an American, can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't. And she wrote that, and she got emails from readers of the journal who said, you know, we never realized how bad things were over there. And her response was, you know, you read my stuff. You, by your own account, you read my stuff for a long time, and I was writing how bad it was. But, I mean, our analysis was she was writing it in the sort of the straight prose, the standard news form that just doesn't quite break through. And we thought that, you know, if we could get reporters to talk in first person the way they would talk, you know, if you had them around a kitchen table late at night, we would get a much better picture of what Iraq was really like, what the war was really like, and what the reporting experience was really like.
We're speaking with Mike Hoyt, executive editor for the Columbia Journalism Review, about his book that he edited with the help of reporting by others. It's called Reporting Iraq, an Oral History of the War by the Journalist Who Covered It. Why do you think reporters are reluctant to – I know the basic tenet of journalism is you separate yourself from your story. You just – to remain objective. You don't want to interject your own opinion. You may put things in context, but you don't want to overanalyze. But to give a true picture of what's happening there, and you're there, it can help to put your own feelings into a piece. But still, reporters are reluctant to do that.
Well, there's the reporting tradition, first mm-hmm. of all. You know, we're objective and neutral and all that. And in war, and especially maybe this war, especially early on in this war, there was tremendous pressure not to be seen as critical to be neutral, I guess. You know, there was a lot of pressure for what they – there was a lot of argument that reporters were only telling the bad news, quote, mm-hmm. and ignoring the good news. And a lot of them talk about this in our book. They really felt it, and they really resented it because they none of them felt that they were selecting bad or good news. They were telling the story, and the story, especially in those years – was not a good story. I mean, it was really a terrible story. And, you know, Iraq was sliding into chaos, and the deaths were climbing. And, you know, that was the story. I mean, you may paint a school, but one end of the street, but if another school is burning at the other end, that's the story. It's not, it's just the way it is. And there was a lot of pressure to remain neutral. But I think more than that, it's just the journalistic tradition. And I think it's one that we could afford to break away from to some extent, especially when you have people like this who have sort of earned the authority to do so. They've been there for months or years, and they know what they're talking about. You know, let them write. Let them mm-hmm. cut them loose a little bit.
I mean, Edward R. Murrow did it, you know, during the Blitz in London. I mean, his personal feelings came through, and he gave listeners a chance to get a feel for what it was like to go through that. I guess that's what you're trying to bring out in these folks.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just a human nature to hear something when it's more personal than when it's just in this neutral sort of newspeak that we tend to write.
292-8513, if you have a question or a comment for Mike Hoyt. He's the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. How do you think the reporting on the Iraq War has been? Do you have any praise, criticism of it? Please share your thoughts. You can email us at openline@wosu.org. You said there were four phases, right, Mike, basically in this war?
Yeah, well, loosely, there's the invasion,
yeah.
And then there's that period afterwards that most of the reporters in our book, or many of them, called it the golden period or something like that, you know, where they really could go anywhere and do anything. And they just felt like their learning curve was really high, which is, mm-hmm. you know, what a good reporter likes, to be really learning and conveying to somebody.
During the invasion, that's where the embeds played a key role, correct? But there also were reporters out doing their own thing.
Yeah, they were both. Dexter Filkins opens our book. He was all by himself. I can read a piece of that if you like.
Please.
He says... The chapter is the beginning. He's from the New York Times. If you look at the whole arc of this thing, it used to be easy in the beginning, but it was never easy. I remember literally the first day I went into Iraq, and it was the day of the invasion. I drove in on my own. I was one of a very small handful of people that actually got across the border in Kuwait, and I was what the American military called a unilateral, he laughs, which is I just had my own car. I think it took about 12 hours that day to find my way across the border into Iraq. In the invasion, I was on my own completely. I had an Arabic translator and I had a photographer, and we made our way to Baghdad by ourselves, basically. And it was pretty insane, and I probably wouldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. And he talks about driving into a town called Safwan. And he says, I went there thinking that this is probably going to be something like what I saw in Afghanistan, which was cheering crowds and people throwing their turbans off and everybody happy to see the American forces. And that wasn't the case at all. To me, it looked like we'd pried the doors off a mental institution, and there were a bunch of people standing around with their jaws hanging open. Some people were absolutely horrified. People were crying. Some people were cheering. Some people were, you could tell how afraid they were. Some people, you could sense that there was an emotion that they didn't want to express, so they didn't. There was a lot of uncertainty.
So in hindsight, that was the first indication that this was not going to be quick and easy.
Yeah. I mean, I think people, reporters tended to recognize this was going to be complicated. I mean, even at the famous scene, you know, where they pulled down Saddam's statues, people, several reporters we talked to were at that site, and they said that was a much more emotionally confused scene. And one reporter, it might have been Ann Garrell, said that, you know, she happened to be standing next to this eye doctor who spoke English, and he said they should take those flags off those tanks. He said no country wants to be invaded.
The American flags.
Yeah.
There was also a bystander to the statue coming down who was a supporter of Saddam, who was a high-ranking member of the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah. And I think he said otherwise, didn't he?
Yes, he said, it's good you're taking it down, but then he showed up later on some kind of wanted list or something.
Yeah. You know, and then, so that was that period. And then suddenly, slowly, you know, the looting and the lawlessness turned into an insurrection, and reporters began at different points. Mm-hmm. We have a chapter called Turning Point, where people realize this at different points, that not only was there an insurrection building, but that the reporters were targets. And that they their lives were in danger.
What were some of the indications they had that it was more than just, you know, pent up, you know, frustration and trying to get back at, you know, the ruling party, and more of an insurgency, that it was anti-West, anti-American?
Well, Filkins again has an account here where he and his driver happened to come across a car bombing, one of the earlier car bombings, and they stop and get out, and he goes to try to cover it and figure out what happened. And the crowd instantly, you know, turns on him, the American, which, you know, Americans had nothing to do with the car bombing, and it didn't make any sense to him, but it made sense to get out of there. And I think they got hit with, he counted something like a couple dozen rocks and bricks hit the car. And he said at one point that he thought the crowd actually could physically hold the car back because it was so many people, but they were able to get away. And, you know, a lot of people had sort of incidents like that where they just realized that they were in danger. The woman whose email I read at the beginning, she just looked out her car window and saw, you know, a bunch of men with guns, and they proceeded to have a high-speed car chase that fortunately they had a faster car.
Yeah. 292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to speak with us. When we come back, we'll take a quick break here on WOSU 820. When we come back, we'll talk more about the whole role of the embedded journalist, the good points and the bad points of that, and also reporting on death and trying to be both get the accurate story out and also be respectful for the soldier or the Iraqi, perhaps, who has been killed or injured. That's when Open Line continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
After September the 11th, Mavish Khan, an American daughter of Afghan immigrants, wanted to do something to help both her country and her parents' country. She found herself working as an interpreter for lawyers representing men held at Guantanamo Bay. I'm Neil Conan. Mavish Khan on her book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 79 degrees at 10:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. The switch to digital TV is coming. You can help older adults with the switch by donating your unneeded converter box coupons to WOSU Public Media. Visit wosu.org/DTV to apply for your coupons today. Or call 292-9678 for more information. Don't forget that weekday mornings you can prepare for the day with Morning Edition starting at 5 a.m. now on WOSU 89.7 FM. In the weather forecast for today, sunny this morning, and then there is a chance of rain showers this afternoon, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high this afternoon around 90 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Angeli today. We are speaking with Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. We're talking about the personal stories of the reporters and the photographers and the other folks who, other journalists who are helping bring the story of the Iraq War to us here and to other people around the world. We welcome your phone calls at 292-8513. Mike, let's talk a bit about the embeds. It was a unique facet of reporting this war. What was the reason why a reporter had to go through all these hoops, both bureaucratic hoops and training and everything else, to be embedded with a unit?
Well, for to be able to see Iraq. Mm-hmm. I mean, at a certain point, you really during the invasion itself, and you wanted probably most reporters probably wanted to be safer than Filkins chose to be, but once it became a very dangerous place, you really couldn't see much of Iraq without embedding, without being with troops. One of the people we interviewed is from what was then Knight Ritter and now McClatchy, a guy named Tom Lassiter, and he said, "To me, not embedding is like not going to a mosque. I can't imagine going to Iraq without spending the time I spent in mosques there, and I can't imagine having gone to Iraq without spending the time I spent embedding." I mean, it's just a way to see part of the story. Mm-hmm. Not everybody feels that way. There's a guy we quoted named Patrick Coburn, who's a Canadian journalist, very gutsy guy who did a lot of wandering around by himself, and he thought it's a great mistake to go with American units and report on any Iraqi city, because I think it's in the nature of things that you're not actually meeting local people, and if you are, you aren't meeting them in circumstances in which they can actually speak. But I think for the most part, I mean, good reporters recognize that they were in a situation where they weren't seeing the whole story, and that Iraqis weren't really talking freely when there's soldiers with big guns around, and so forth. And they tried to balance out their reporting in other ways to make sure they had something approximating the truth.
It's tough to balance between, the reporters were protected by these Marines and these soldiers. It has to be tough to balance your loyalty, your natural loyalty to them, not to mention your own natural loyalty to your country, with telling an accurate story of what's going on. How do the reporters balance that, especially when something bad happened in the unit they were with?
I think they worked at it. I think they were constant. I mean, this is a problem in journalism anyway. There's lots of stories of the police reporters, say, who becomes almost more of a cop than a reporter. I mean, I remember my first paper, there was a guy like that who was, every story was the police side of things, and that's not the way the world is. Sometimes the police make mistakes just like anyone else. So, you kind of like these people. They not only like them, they're protecting your life, and you witness their acts of bravery and their acts of kindness often, and you see that part of it, but you tend not to see other things, which is that maybe actually we have a piece coming up in our next issue, which I should mention, our September issue. Mike Massey, one of our contributing editors, talking about his embedding experience, and he found something interesting. I think he spent a lot of time, and he sort of found himself absorbing this sort of sense of progress and American know-how and that kind of thing, and a sort of an attitude that the Iraqis are just incompetent, they can't do anything, what are they going to do without us, and so forth. And it's a big triumph when you get garbage pickup and so forth. But he said only when he sort of got away from it did he realize that, Iraq was a functioning society before we invaded, and a lot of our actions, dismantling the government and de-bathifying and so forth, that actually destroyed that government, and no wonder it's not functioning, and you tend to forget that when you're there. Mm-hmm. You get sort of seduced by the attitudes of those people who you meet and who you like.
So it's good to make sure that you don't embed too long, that you are getting at least, maybe if you're embedded for a few weeks, you're out, elsewhere for a few weeks talking to other people.
Yeah, it's good to be work to be intellectually honest and sort of check your own impressions and sort of check other sources of information.
Mm-hmm. Now, especially during the invasion, the embeds had their material censored, correct, by military?
Well, I don't think we got many stories of censoring.
Mm-hmm.
There were rules about saying where the troops were and where they were moving and that kind of thing, and you know, there were very few instances of any problems there. There were some, it often depended on the officer in charge. Many of them, young officers, had a full understanding of the importance of the free press, and as long as you were factually accurate, they had no problem with what you did. Others were a little more heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm. Did videotape and things like that have to go through any kind of censorship before it was sent out to the general public?
I think it was kind of case by case.
Yep.
That we end the book with a story of a guy named Chris Hondros, who's a fantastic photographer, who he was there at a checkpoint when there was an awful incident where a family was coming and didn't see the soldiers, who were mm-hmm. actually kind of hidden, and soldiers ended up shooting up the car and killing the parents and wounding one of the two children in the back. And he just quietly took these photos. It's really kind of a heartrending story. And then after that, he had the images. He didn't. The light quality was low. He didn't know what he had, and so forth. And there was an effort by the officer in charge to say, you know, we'd like to see those. We'd like to hold those if we could. And he said, yeah, sure. Talk to my boss. And it got very confusing. But the bottom line was, he felt his job was to get those pictures out. This happens a lot in Iraq, and people should see it. It was his rationale. And he did so, and it's just it is the bottom line is the mission of the press is to tell the story as it happened.
What did that do to his relationship with that unit and the future relationship to the military?
Probably didn't help it.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't help the officer who career of the officer who was temporarily in charge.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of confusing, but. The bottom line was the pictures got out and they were all over the world the next day.
That's what I was going to ask. The technology makes it a lot easier to sort of, if there is attempted censorship, to thwart it, because it is, within minutes the picture can be up and around the world.
That's true. And that makes kind of the system that was in place for the first Gulf War kind of impossible. I mean, you can... Your equipment you can be in contact with it instantly.
Mm-hmm. Reporters censored themselves. I mean, the reporter's creed also always is do no harm, or certainly do the least amount of harm. And these reporters would not, transmit pictures of a fallen soldier out of respect for him or her and the soldier's family, the Marine's family. Give us some examples of that, of how reporters and journalists were really torn as far as telling the story and also respecting, obviously a tragedy.
Well, I think it's kind of an American journalistic tradition that you don't show at least American bodies. Our tradition is much more conservative in that regard than, say, Europe, which has less qualms about seeing, the brutality of war in their journalism. You rarely see a dead American. We have one in the book, which is a striking picture. It's in a Fallujah, and it's in a kitchen, and so it's the contrast to this sort of domestic kitchen scene, and this poor guy who got shot as he came into the house.
It's a Marine, right?
It's a Marine.
He died.
Officer,
mm-hmm.
And he did die. And that picture was never a stunning picture, and it was never seen in the States until somebody did a story about self-censorship. And then it was printed. In part, it's just the American tradition. You don't put that on the breakfast table with somebody, and you don't, you certainly don't put anything out before the family's been notified. That's rock solid.
Yeah, we can understand the as far as the family notified, but why do you think that tradition is there? I mean, you could argue that more images like that would perhaps, in an ideal world, prevent us from going to war. When you see something as as dramatic as that, something as sad as that, really. Say, look, this is what's happening over here now.
It's a tension, you know. It's a tension between showing people what really is versus some sense of decorum. And I don't know. I guess if I was an editor, I would push a little anyway toward more reality. Because, you know, I mean, all these things are, you know, happening in our name. You know, at the bottom, that's what this is about. We're witnessing for our democracy. So we should see what we were doing over there.
In the first Gulf War, it looked like a video game. I mean, you really didn't get to see any, you know, any of the effects of the bombs that were fired through the crosshairs that we saw with General Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell's briefings.
That's true.
292-8513, 292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, we're speaking about the personal experiences of journalists who have covered and who are covering the war in Iraq. Speaking of embeds, you have a story of it's a shared story. It's one of the reporters shares a story about a French photographer who was embedded with insurgents, not embedded with Western troops, but with insurgents, and this reporter witnessed these insurgents attacking a plane, which I thought was incredible. The insurgents just said that he never knew where he was going from day to day, and they said we're leaving. We get out to that near the airport, and he takes photographs of them shooting down a DHL plane, and the reaction the insurgents had to that.
The reporter, as I remember, didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Was shocked and fearful.
Yeah, he was afraid he would be killed if he said anything.
Yeah.
So he just basically did his job
as
if he was a fly in the wall. And he took a lot of heat from military commanders because those pictures were splashed all around the world pretty quickly.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
There was another guy who was embedded with insurgents who tells an incredible story. I don't know if I could find it real quick, but his name is Gaith Abdul Ahad, and he speaks Arabic. And he was sitting with some guys as they were cleaning their guns and talking to them and getting their story about how they came. These were actually people who had come from other countries to fight on behalf of Al-Qaeda. And another guy comes up and says, "Who's this you're talking to?" And he says, "Oh, he's a journalist." And he says, "Oh, why don't we kill him?" And, you know, later, you know, they decide not to, obviously. And then later he reflects on, you know, what was I doing there?
Yeah. That's another – I mean, that's going to be hard for a Western journalist, too, to remain objective when you're not just external pressure to support the troops, but your own internal pressure as well to carry the flag, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think any American journalist is going to not do anything to cause any harm to an American soldier if they can. They just won't do it. I mean, I think it's not anything to fight. I think it's just the way it should be.
The pressure to find good news. We touched on it briefly, but these reporters, I mean, that when things went really bad, you know, 2006 and so forth, there was a lot of – I mean, you kept hearing the president saying, "You're not hearing about the good news that's happening in Iraq, the progress we're making in Iraq." These reporters felt that pressure.
They did, especially during the period when the CPA was in charge and Mr. Bremer was in charge. They didn't really feel this in their accounts from the military. It was really the civilians from the CPA who, in many cases, were sort of political hacks who were really more interested in victory propaganda than they were in the actual telling what was going on. And there's just story. We have a chapter on this. There's just kind of story after story of people seeing things with their own eyes and then going to the press conference and being told something else. And there's one British reporter, he goes into the green zone and talks to somebody about the gasoline shortage. And the guy says, "What gasoline shortage?" He says, "Our reports show that there's plenty of gasoline." Well, you know, just a mile away, there's all kinds of lines at all the gas stations. There was a gasoline shortage, in fact. And some of these people were just so disconnected from what was going on. I can read you a little piece. This is Borzu Dargai. He's a Los Angeles Times reporter, I believe still reporting from Iraq. He says, I just remember having this feeling like this is a very political exercise and they're a product for the media at this point. What would really be horrible is if the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, actually believes this crap. And I remember thinking that from the very beginning. I hope they don't believe this stuff. I hope they're not consuming this stuff themselves. And pretty soon it started dawning on me, no, they're not just BSing us because we're the public. They actually believe this stuff. We're in trouble.
And as books have they, because they weren't getting out of the green zone. They didn't see what was going on.
Yeah, they didn't see what was going on, and they wanted to believe what they wanted to believe rather than what, you know, independent evidence would show them.
Did reporters have doubts about, I mean, we take criticism here even, you know, in the United States that we cover the bad news. You know, the old line is, when the plane lands safely, it's not news, but when it crashes, it is news. That we dwell too much on the negative. Did reporters second-guess their own reporting to see if they were being too negative?
Yeah, actually, some of them did talk about that. You know, hearing that you're only interested in the bad news over and over again has its effect. And I think one of the Washington Post reporters talked about how he let that affect him on a particular story, and he thinks he really regrets it. He thinks he told a rosier story than was really true. Anthony Shadid, who's an excellent reporter and who speaks Arabic, but he this gets to you,
mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes they hear it from an editor at home. You know, is there any? What's the progress? What's the good news? And you know, you want to tell that if it's an accurate story, but if it's not happening, which it wasn't for a long period there, it's hard to report.
We're speaking with Mike Hoyt, executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, about the Columbia Journalism Review's book, Reporting Iraq, An Oral History of the War by the Journalists Who Covered It. It's a collection of first-person accounts by about 44 journalists who were in Iraq and who continued to cover the war in Iraq. Mike, did you find any difference between let's start with nationalities, how American journalists felt about covering this war as opposed to British journalists or French journalists or any other nationality. Is there a difference there in editing this work?
Well, that's an interesting question. I suppose the Americans just had more emotional involvement because it's our country, and you know, it's our triumph when we're successful. It's our fault when we screw it up, and it becomes a more complicated thing. I guess the Europeans were just sort of able to be the disinterested party to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have different styles. Europeans tend to be a little freer. You know, in terms of style, than Americans, who tend to be neutral and write to a certain form. I don't know. The Arab journalists were very awfully interesting. I mean, and gutsy. They just seemed to be so gutsy. I mean, they weren't. You know, the universe was not alien to them. They were. In an area where they felt comfortable, but boy, they really took some chances. So this guy that mentioned, this former doctor, mm-hmm. had some incredible stories to tell about chances they took, and the fellow I just mentioned who was with the insurgents. I mean, they were quite something.
Did you find any difference? I mean, we've all heard the liberal bias of National Public Radio and the conservative bias of Fox News. Those are the two extremes. But did you find any difference based on the organization for which these reporters worked?
No, I didn't. And, you know, these people, you just have to have respect for these people. I mean, Richard Engel from NBC is one of the more dedicated people I've come across, you know, secondhand through other people's interviews. But NPR, I don't think anybody could accuse her of liberal bias. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's given some of the most detailed and close to the ground and informed reports of anybody over there.
Speaking of Ann Garrels.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry. No, I didn't really see much difference.
Okay. Reporting is reporting for these folks, no matter who they worked for.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Dwayne, you're on the air with Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. Go ahead, Dwayne.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Dwayne.
PBS, the now television show, aired something in Afghanistan. I was wondering if you're aware of the kind of weapons we're using over there. They showed something that looked like a firebomb used against the Afghanistan insurgents.
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. This was a current report.
Oh, I guess so. Yeah, he's gone. The weaponry that these journalists saw and the destruction they can cause had to have a lasting impact on them as well.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, especially during the invasion phase, you know, heavy weaponry does heavy damage and it does heavy collateral damage, and there was plenty of that.
The current situation, what's it like now to report in Iraq? Is it easier? Is it harder?
Well, I think it's very hard. It's in part because it's a different story. Now it's more, there's a sort of a complicated political story and the Sunnis versus the Shiites and stuff that's where the story is. There's an eerie quiet. It's partly because of the surge. It's mm-hmm. partly because of the Shiites' ceasefire and because the Sunnis, large groups of the Sunnis have come over to realize that al-Qaeda is a worse enemy than the U.S. And there's this sort of balance, and things are quiet, and yet it remains, you know, very dangerous and partly quiet because some of these neighborhoods are now no longer mixed. They're now, you know, they've either Sunni or Shiite, and there's nobody to fight there anymore. And partly because just a lot of these neighborhoods are kind of walled off. And so there's a quiet, and yet it's kind of an eerie quiet, and you wonder, you know, you're not sure exactly what's next.
Do reporters feel safer to go out now? Is it close to that point right after the invasion where they were able to operate pretty freely, or is it still pretty tough to get out?
I think it's still very tough to get out, and there are far fewer reporters now than there ever were, partly for that reason of danger, partly for that reason of expense, partly, unfortunately, for the reason that readers and viewers seem less interested in reporting on the war than they used to.
Why do you think that is? I mean, we've heard that interest goes up as the casualty rate goes up. Is it as simple as that, or are there other things to worry about now?
I think a lot of people are tired of it. It's a long war. It goes back to 2003, and it's there's been a lot of bad news out of it, and I think there's a fatigue to some extent. I wish that was not true. I think, you know, when we send soldiers over there, we should send reporters, and we should keep, you know the politics and the military situation and everything. It should be prominently played on TV and in the newspaper, you know, as much as possible. But it's a more difficult story, and it's harder to get at, and I think people are just a little tired of it.
292-8513, 292-8513, just about 6 or 7 minutes left with Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. The Columbia Journalism Review's book is called Reporting Iraq, an Oral History of the War by the Journalists Who Covered It. You know, the critics would say there's less reporting there now because it is better news, and it gives fuel to the fire that reporters were only interested in covering when things were bad there.
Well, I think the better news has been pretty thoroughly covered. Mm-hmm. We all know that the casualties are down, and that the you know, the sons of Iraq are on our side, the Sunnis who have signed up with us, I think that's well reported.
Mm-hmm. Are more reporters heading to Afghanistan? We keep hearing that more and more American troops are heading there. Are the war correspondents moving on to the different front now?
I hope so. I mean, I think that's been terribly underreported, and I hope the networks and the big papers will step up.
Let's go to the phones. Justin, you're on the air with Mike Hoyt from Columbia Journalism Review.
Well, your question you just had now about why are people less interested in following the coverage struck a chord with me, because for me, there's a disconnect where I don't know what's going on. What is it that we're doing there? What's the fight about? And I think that's part of the reason people feel disconnected to the war, is what are we supposed to be thinking about, or what are the troops doing there? You know, and maybe if there was a clear goal that we thought, hey, they're getting closer to reaching the goal, then people would be more interested. But I personally just, it's like I think about what's going on, and I don't know what I respect them and I support the troops, but I don't know what are they doing, or what is it they're working towards.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
Well, I mean, I think there's still an Al-Qaeda force there that is still killing people, and I think, you know, there may not have been before the invasion, but there certainly is now. And part of the mission is to, you know, capture and destroy those people. And then the other part is to train the Iraqis to be able to do that themselves, to help them step up. And that's a complicated story. Not easy to portray, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else, Justin?
And a little hard to measure.
No, I understand. Mm-hmm. I hope they're... It sounded like hopefully the Iraqi forces are making progress. So, you know, I think they've done good work. Hopefully it keeps getting better.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. 292-8513, 292-8513. Just a couple of minutes left with Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of Columbia Journalism Review. What are these reporters, you know, 5-10 years down the road, what are they taking away from their experiences there? It still lingers with them. You mentioned the Ann Garrels breaking down with her stepdaughter after hearing explosions on a mountainside to prevent avalanches. They suffer a lot of the same effects that the soldiers have suffered from.
Some of them will, I think. You know, having gone through some of the worst parts of that situation, I think they will. Each will be different, just like soldiers are different. Reporters have something of an outlet, though. They can write. I mean, a bunch of these people are writing books, yeah. Really good books. There's so many of them, they don't get a whole lot of attention, but there's an awful lot of good writing, and that's something that I think helps people deal with their experience. Dexter Filkins, Ann Garrels, yeah. There's just all kinds of books.
What has the profession learned from covering this war? How will the next war be covered from the lessons that we learned here?
That's a good question. I think smart people will sit down and talk about that. I'm not sure I'm the expert on it. I think probably the embedding will continue. I mean, I think it's been from the military point of view, it's been a great success. I mean, they like it. They get their people get a sense of what it is they do, and from embedding. I think journalists will continue to embrace it, and the good ones will work hard to balance that experience with other kinds of reporting that give them different perspectives, so that what they write in the end is informed by multiple perspectives. And that's not easy, but I think that, you know, good journalists will do it.
Do you think this was a good first draft of the history of this war that these reporters have covered, have told?
Well, I think the run-up to the war, the Washington part of it, was really a bad chapter in American journalism. I don't think we covered the argument for the war nearly well enough. There wasn't nearly enough challenge to the rationales for the war, and that's really... You know, when you go to war, you propose to go to war, then there should be a real debate. There should be a real challenge, and the news media should be part of that. And there was such patriotic fervor and the post 9/11 rage and all that stuff that I think I just don't think we did well there. Yeah. Once the war started, I think there are holes in the coverage. Like some of the reporters wonder why they didn't get the story of the contractor sooner, for example. Although it was a difficult story, but nonetheless, or you know, the torture and abuse, another difficult story. Yeah. But
we'll have to, Mike, we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thanks very much, Mike Hoyt, executive editor of the Columbia's Journalism Review on WOSU and WOSU HD 820.